Hey there, it's Brie Bagel with your OnlyFans recap, and I could have talked to Rachel Loy all day, but we really do cover a lot of ground in this episode. I talk a lot about Rachel on this podcast, as you know, but some backstory. I've known Rachel Loy and her husband, Brian Keene, since 2011. Through my first booking agent, Nick Ferrata, and Rick and Bev Lambert got us some shows together early on in my full-time playing career, and I will never forget watching Rachel sing and play bass fronting a band in Nashville back in 2011, I think on the Billy Block show. Whew, she killed it, and I was just stunned by her. I found out Rachel was producing records after becoming obsessed with William Clark Green's record Rose Queen, and when she agreed to produce my 2018 In My Defense project, we began a beautiful journey of creation together and now a close friendship that I really treasure. She's played bass with the biggest stars and on the biggest albums as a session player, like the current Ella Langley record, y'all. But I think she's the biggest superstar of everyone, being a brilliant, classy, extraordinary entrepreneur as a singer-songwriter, bassist, producer, and now co-creator of Playola, while being an amazing mama too. Her insight and intelligent conversation in this episode is just so on brand for her. So be sure and download the Playola radio app and listen to my station, Band Radio, B-A-N-N-E-D, of course. And you'll love that too, because we love everything she does. Thanks, Rachel. Enjoy. Hey, y'all, it's Brie Bagwell. I want to invite you to join me August 12th through 16th in Red River, New Mexico for 8750 Music Festival. This boutique festival features 4 days and 4 nights of outstanding musical performances across 5 venues and includes a barbecue cook-off and a red and a green chili cook-off. 3-day passes are on sale now, and your ticket gets you into every show of the festival and includes 2 free meals. You can get tickets, sign up to compete in the cook-off, and learn more at 8750festival.com. That's 8750festival.com. And use coupon OnlyVans. That's OnlyVans, all caps, no space at checkout to get $10 off your 3-day pass. 8750 Festival, adjust your altitude. By the way, me and producer Kyle, we're both playing at the festival, so you can come see us there. I'm sure, like, what an evolution. You're like, wow, I'm the person that, and then you're like, well, I can just pick and choose what I want to do now.
I do feel like that is the pot of gold at the end of the shit rainbow of getting old. Yeah. Like, at this point, I've played every size venue, every type of large event.
Hey, hey, everybody. This is Brie Bagwell, and this is my podcast, Only Vans, where I talk to my friends in my van.
I feel like in the last like 4 or 5 months since Brian and I have been like full speed ahead, like in sort of like startup mentality and up and down stress wise because of that, like emotionally, it's just like a roller coaster, you know?
Yeah.
And he's been drinking every night. And so I started like joining him. He started like pouring me glasses of wine. So then I got in the habit of it again. And now it doesn't gross me out because I'm in the habit. But then we just got hit with a stomach bug this last weekend. It ripped through all 5 of us. It was terrible.
I need it. Can you give me the stomach
bug? It was only like, for my kids, it lasted 6 hours total.
That's the perfect stomach bug.
Uh-huh.
How long did it last in your stomach?
Well, it started getting better after 6 hours, but I was exhausted for a good 24. And Brian's was like mine plus 50%.
I need like a summer stomach bug. Just for like those last 10 pounds.
You should. I know. Get a colonoscopy. Then no one will suspect that you're doing it for the wrong reasons.
I had a colonoscopy. Did I tell you this story? I had a colonoscopy. This is recording. Great. We're starting. This is a perfect place to start. The anesthesiologist had not plugged in my IV all the way, and I was a week. And what? I was in so much pain that I like squeezed. They had all these interns. This is great. They had all these interns in my colonoscopy. There's like 10 people in the room.
Wow.
And I was in so much pain. I like grabbed his hand and I was like looking at him like, help me. And he's like, I think she's awake. And the doctor's like, no, she's not. And I was like, I saw the pouch in my colon where I have diverticulitis. I saw the pouch. He was like, you weren't awake. And I was like, I told him every detail
of my colonoscopy, and he said, "Oh my gosh, you were awake," and I was wide awake. So anyway.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was awful.
That and then the dentist thing messing up your lip.
Oh yeah, the dentist took out a chunk of my lip yesterday. I know.
We need to find you some competent doctors.
Gosh.
I'm telling you, you gotta be picky about that. We don't even know that we can be. But like, okay, Brian would have one kidney right now if we didn't get a second opinion and go to Cleveland Clinic, where the guy who does kidney surgeries all day long did his surgery.
In Ohio. That's mm-hmm. the place to go.
Mm-hmm. But you can't go to Ohio every time you got to get your teeth cleaned.
Yeah. Well, my friend is a dentist, and so she moved. Mm-hmm. And I stayed with this one because my dental insurance, like, quote unquote, covers it. Well, mm-hmm. they don't cover mm-hmm. it. And now I have a chunk of my lip missing. So.
Oh, my God.
Coming back to see you, Taylor.
Horrifying.
Do you have ham? Do you guys use ham here or no?
Mm-mm. Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of musicians do, but we don't have to, so we're not going to dip into that.
Dang, that's mm-hmm. you have your own insurance, like
yeah, private? Because like Brian works for big company as what turns out to be the most efficient side hustle he's ever had.
Right, he was like, "I'm just going to learn computer code,
yeah,
and then we can get health insurance."
Mm-hmm.
That's so smart,
and he got that job less than 1 year before he got deathly ill, which would have put us into debt for years, even with Obamacare or whatever. I mean, he was like in the hospital for, I think, like 6 days from the sepsis.
Mm-mm.
And then we had to go straight from there, you know, heal up for a month and then drive to Cleveland Clinic during COVID to get the tumor removed from his kidney, which had nothing to do with the sepsis. It was just the sepsis was the fortunate like the
hello,
the windfall, the luck windfall of like, hey, let's get a random full body CT scan and catch the stage 1 kidney cancer before it turns into something that would kill you.
That's wild. One time at a show, cause we were building our house, and one time at a show, I was like, do I have any septic friends? and my friend Cassie was like, hey, like she's had sepsis before. And like I thought of Brian too. I was like, oh, I meant septic tank friends.
Oh, like people who work on septic tanks.
Yeah. I had to be careful how I
If anyone
that.
In here is septic, get to a hospital right now. Dial 911.
I totally was like foot, mouth. Great. That was crazy that y'all, that was during COVID. That was wild.
Mm-hmm.
When did he start doing that? He started like 2019 then?
Doing what? Oh, the side hustle?
Yeah.
Must have been 2019 because it was Valentine's Day of 2020 that he got sick.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
He went through COVID and that
mm-hmm.
at the same time.
Yep. And we were so grateful that because it was a big decision, like, you know, gosh, do we do this thing that we might like get stuck in like golden handcuffs or whatever, right. you know? And man, it turns out that like he's learned so much essential stuff. He went from being like an exceptional coder to being also like a total expert and used to dealing with large teams and scaling and all that stuff. So like
that's amazing.
And running a team. He like ran a whole team in Argentina, which is why we moved to Mexico. And
yeah. Well, we're not here to talk about him. Okay. I'm going to talk to him later. I know. I want to talk about Mexico. I want to talk when I was driving here. It's so insane because I told Paul, I said, I don't know how to even begin a podcast with her because you are amazing singer-songwriter, producer, one of the most sought-after bass players. You have a podcast. You're a mom. Mm-hmm. You are starting this new entrepreneurial venture. Mm-hmm. You like what when you wake up in the morning... What do you decide what to do? Like, that might be my first question because it's like, you have so much.
Right.
That you can do. That's like many different parts of your brain.
Yeah. Honestly, like, I think there's like a constant running tab of a million small things to do, like a mountain of it. And like on a good week, I'm keeping tabs on the things that are like, need to be taken care of. Or like the priority things, certain things mm-hmm. rise to the top. So I just put whatever is in the priority, like the top priority. That's the first thing that I do. So for instance, like this week, it's like we're about to launch like 3 or 4 more big stations for Playola. And so I really need to get those interviews on the book. So whenever those guys can interview, you know, getting a date down and then like being present for the interviews where we create their station, that's my top priority. But then there's other weeks, like next week, I'm going to Nashville on Monday. And so my priority when I wake up that day will be to stock the house and prepare the children and communicate with whoever is helping me out while I'm gone, whether it's Brian or whether it's our part-time nanny, and like make sure that my hard drives are backed up because I'm about to get up on a plane or whatever, you know? So it's like, that's a different kind of day. And then with the days that I wake up in Nashville, my priorities are always like, usually I'm producing a session when I'm there or co-writing. So then I kind of like switch my mindset there. So yeah, it really just depends on what sort of day it is.
That's so wild. Because it could be, and you are a really good household runner, I will say.
Ooh, thank you.
Like on top of everything else, you make the best food. That's like reason number 3 why you're my producer. It's like great job, and then the food. But for, you have a way of still balancing that, which is really wild.
Oh, man. Thank you. I think that's because we started when the kids were little, we were kind of extreme about stuff. It was almost like running a farm because we had like watched some movies or read some books about just like the toxicity of the food here and how the EU rejects certain foods that come from America. So we just like as a couple, we're like, OK, we're not buying bread off the shelf anymore. And we're like, I just made everything from scratch at that time of life when they were little. You may as well, because it's like something that you can do while you're basically taking care of your kids' physical needs all the time and being constantly interrupted with those. And so it was sort of like a nice parallel task to always have going on, the housekeeping and the fooding. And I think from that like time of life, it just kind of has gradually thinned out where that's not necessary. But now I have those chops.
Yeah, I remember you making bread when they were little and we were making our first record. And it's crazy how the world has shifted from, I mean, I remember just moving to Austin and being like, oh my gosh, food and plastics. And it was a big deal. And everyone was kind of like, okay, hippie. And now everyone's like, oh, hey, this stuff, no matter who you are.
Yep.
It's, this is bad.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know if you told me to read Wheat Belly or not, but.
No, I've never read that. So it okay. Wasn't me.
Wild. But you're already, you don't need to, you already make your own bread. Yeah.
But I'm also dipping into probably the same wheat supplies, right? Like if I'm buying flour off the shelf.
Right.
And I don't make like hipster bread. I don't like grow my own yeast baby like a lot of people right. do. That's like, first of all, I just don't want something gross in a jar on my counter all the time.
Yeah, that is a little, maybe that's what's deterring me too. I'm like, ugh. Yeah. It's like a science experiment.
And I don't know if it totally cancels out the goodness I think I'm doing by using like active dry bread machine yeast or whatever. But yeah, I don't get into the like, I never got to the point where my bread was like, you know, sourdough and like so cool. Plus, I think my kids just wouldn't eat that bread. I think they'd be like, this is sour.
What about me? I'm your other child that eats here when we're making records. You have to feed a whole other person.
Yeah, well, maybe you and I can
we can go down the
figure
sourdough.
That part out for the next project.
How about you figure it out with all that extra time you have making records and making a radio station? Okay, so when it comes to producing, which that's exciting that you're going there to produce. We make our records in Nashville, and I like to talk about just the process because a lot of people. I think that they say, why do you do your records that way? And they're just curious or they're like, that seems way more expensive. But actually for someone like me, it's more cost efficient because you and I find that what I need from a producer, which is different from what everyone needs, but you are the person that will sit down and tear apart a song with me, put it back together, find what's wrong with it, which might be nothing or might be a lot. Or challenge me to rewrite a second verse or whatever. And then we get the song pretty much ready to go. Mm-hmm. And when we walk in the studio, it is so fun. We knock out 5 songs in a day or even we used to do 5 songs in half a day. This last time we took a full day. But do you, what if I'm like, do you enjoy making records that way? And you're like, absolutely not. It's my least You're too poor.
I don't know. It's a means to an end.
It's just like, yeah. I mean, is that kind of what you do with most people you produce, or is it different every time, or what?
No, yeah. I do, because most people I produce are not the kinds of people who can be like, let's rent out Blackbird for 10 days and right. like do everything there. I feel like working with artists that have a limited budget restricts me to artists who like really care about what's happening, and also artists that I just relate to. Like, this is the world that I've always lived into. I haven't lived in, I mean, one time I was on a major label and that was fun, and we made a record in this, you know, super relaxed kind of way. But even then I worked with a producer mostly in an overdub studio. The fact is that the bulk of the time making anyone's record that you spend is on the back end doing things that nobody consciously hears. So you may as well like just organize. If you organize your time, you can get a really expensive sound with a small budget. And that's always been the thing I like to give to artists. That plus the idea, like, I love the idea of me and the artist going in at a certain level, and when all is said and done, us both being on the next level of whatever that is. Wherever we start, we get to that next level. So sometimes that applies to me. Sometimes it only applies to the artist. But for me, it's like, it's about really digging in to what the artist wants and developing who they are and finding that sound. And so much of that is usually done one-on-one. Mm-hmm. With the songs, mm-hmm. and like no one getting paid but me, you know,
or you not even getting,
just or kidding. Yeah, in the case of some artists, sure.
Or you're just thinking about, you know, you were asking me what do you love right now, and what I loved right now was Mother Road by Grace Potter, and so we kind of mm-hmm. got to go in, and you have built. I mean, I don't think people really understand what level of a. Or how valuable it is to have somebody like you who can, you've curated the best players for me every time we've done a record, because you are in the session with the best players in Nashville, and you can call them and get them on my record, and they know you, and you guys already have this synergy. Mm-hmm. So when you go mm-hmm. in and you're playing bass with Fred Eltringham, who's Sheryl Crow's drummer and mm-hmm. one of the best drummers,
yeah,
you guys can talk without talking or whatever.
Right. We have a rapport already.
Yeah.
In between the words, just musically, you know. And I will say, like, I've never produced a record without having first been in the Nashville studio scene, where my comfort zone is a bunch of players in a room communicating and creating the whole arrangement on the fly. You know, like, that's always been my comfort zone. And, like, the byproduct of that is that I do know most of the players, most of the heavy hitters there, and like what colors they would bring to our palette, and like what they're like, I always want to grab the players depending on what we're aiming for musically, that like once we're in there, I get to just like let, I want them to be able to use their instincts. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I don't want to get the players whose instincts would not serve the sound we're going for and then ask them to be someone they're not. We're going for this one thing. And my favorite thing is that each artist in each like era of each artist, like the record, the last record we make versus the first one, was a completely different like set of colors that we wanted, you know. And I love changing that up.
Yeah,
you know,
it was really interesting. The first record too, we made, I mean, we were making that in 2017, I think, and mm-hmm. I think you were pregnant.
I was pregnant with Ruby.
Uh-huh. And we went in and you were you told me, you were like, this is one of the first times that a couple of these guys, I haven't been a session player alongside with them. I'm producing and you're playing bass at the same time, which is wild. but you were kind of, I don't want to say nervous, but you were like a little bit like this. We'll see how this goes, because I've never been like their producer and their session player for a couple of them.
Right.
And
right.
that was, and then afterwards, I remember you just went, and I was like, you did a great job. Like, you did a great job. It was, it seemed so seamless.
Yep.
There were no, you know, not that explosion, but apparently they do happen. They've never happened in our sessions, but apparently not.
A lot of times they're quiet too, but like a session player who doesn't want to be there or feels like, or like if the power structure is off, there really does have to be sort of a chain of command. And whoever is in command really needs to own it.
Yeah.
Or certain players will resist it and subvert that. And then what happens is that at the end of a very expensive day that you can't get back, especially when it comes to like if we made an arrangement decision as a group that affected the drums, whether it's a tempo decision or a general energy decision, you know, we have to redo a bunch of stuff, which could be a $10,000 disruption,
yeah.
You know? And I've definitely had that happen in sessions before where I had certain players who were just unhappy to be there for whatever reason, or felt like they're above this and yeah. like they need to impart their wisdom upon this artist and definitely say things like, oh, well, you don't want to do a power ballad. Believe me. I mean, and like rule out right. a whole, maybe like a whole idea and a whole path that the artist was thinking to go down. And then the artist is so sensitive on that day and, you know, just kind of goes, oh, yeah, you know, so-and-so says I shouldn't do that. And he really knows. So, of course, I wouldn't do that. Oh, yeah, I'm not going to be uncool. But like maybe that's where we should have tried it. And all ideas are on the table, especially if the artist is like, I don't know, that sounds cool. Like,
yeah,
it creates an environment of like fear and self-consciousness. So when I do call a new player that I haven't worked with before, that's what's kind of at risk. Nowadays, I'm more of a grown ass woman. Like, you know, so Ruby's 8. So that was like 9 years ago. Yeah. So, I mean, I was like 33. No, I was 34 when we made that record, which isn't, you know, non-grown.
It does sound like baby to me. Like even me thinking of me at 34, I'm like, oh, I didn't know anything. But we did. I mean,
right.
We did. But it does feel like so long ago.
Yes. Like I was definitely qualified to be in the producer chair at that yeah. point. But I can't remember if I had been through. Oh, yeah, I had been through a really pivotal experience. So I was more serious at that point about owning my power, or like really bossing and considering that, like, if I'm bossing well, that's me doing a good job. That's not me being an overbearing bitch.
Hey, this is Bree Bagwell, and if you want to listen to this podcast early and ad-free, subscribe to my Patreon at www.patreon.com/BreeBagwell.
Howdy, y'all. It's Bree Bagwell, and I know y'all support the people who support me, so let me tell you about Deep Ellum Brewing Company. Born and raised in Deep Ellum, Texas, Deep Ellum Brewing Company has really made its mark on the beer world. Known for its flagships, Dallas Blonde and Deep Ellum IPA, they put boring beers to shame with a full lineup that's unapologetically not brewed to style. My personal favorite is the Dallas Blonde. It is so easy to drink. I just took it home for the holidays, and my whole family was like, obsessed with this beer. No joke. They drank it all. Thanks a lot, family. So head over to deepellumbrewing.com to open the beer vault and give your fridge what it deserves. And you'll see why love runs deep for Deep Ellum Brewing Company. Available in Texas and Oklahoma, side effects may include severe happiness. Deep Ellum Brewing Company products are for individuals 21 and older, and we encourage drinking responsibly.
Are you ready to take your merchandise to the next level? Well, just ask me who I use, and that is CH Lone Star Promo. They specialize in screen printing and direct-to-garment, embroidery, laser engraving, anything promo-related, they can do it. Step up your merch game now with CH Lone Star Promo and tell them Brie and Whiskey sent you.
Which is the line that we walk, isn't it? Because it's like, I've seen male producers throw fits.
Oh, yeah.
And that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot throw fits. Like, but I can, or I should, if I'm not getting the respect. Yeah.
I would now, but I would probably do it privately.
Oh.
Right? Like, with whoever needs to be reamed. I might ream someone in private.
Oh.
But I would do that now for sure. After a certain experience that I had with a group that we all are familiar with, I learned that sometimes you have to be hated momentarily or in general and like get over it. It's uncomfortable. But you know what? You're safe. We don't live in the caveman world where if I'm hated, my physical person might be threatened. Like, no, people can dislike me and I just have to soothe myself through it. What really matters is that I own the role of like taking the artist's money and giving them the record that they're really proud of that feels like them.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like the session players. It doesn't feel like me. It feels like them and what they want to say. And my job is to remove all the obstacles between that. So, yeah, when I hire new players who might have like a larger set of credits than me, or like, yeah, just like operate in circles, egos and all that stuff. Yeah, like it is a risk, but I would know how to handle that now. Like it's less of a risk now because I could I could stand up to that. But at the time that we made the first record together, I was not as practiced standing up to that. And I had like fallen prey to that. I had had to re-record a few of Brian's songs for that reason, for like a session player kind of like, you know, hijacking the vibe and giving
which is
results.
Totally wild, because that doesn't really, you don't really live that long in the session world if you have that behavior, or I guess you can and I don't know, or like I guess people put up with it or whatever, but like
it just depends on which session you're on.
Yeah, because you have to be as sought after as you are as a session player. I mean, you are playing on the number one, as we're recording this, number one song in the country, Choose in Texas by Ella Langley. Mm-hmm. So you were on that record, and people, did Miranda choose you for that session?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what an honor.
Yeah. She's actually thrown me a lot of opportunities, because she hired me for her record, and a lot of that was because they knew I was in Austin, so that's how they got the idea. Right. And she had never worked with me before that, but we had such a great time and a great synergy in the studio, and then she's been really, like, bringing me into new circles and stuff. It's cool.
Oh, my gosh. That... Guys, we have an emergency.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Texas Weather Service.
Yeah. Listen, got her back. Raining. It's rained 1 inch, and we need to tell everybody about it. No, that's great. And that's, you know... That's your reputation. If Kenny Chesney needs a fill-in bass player harmony, like, you are the person that can go play in a stadium. If like any of the big award shows want the best at it, they call you, and you have the ability to even turn that down now if you want.
True.
Which, how does that feel? Because I'm sure, like, what an evolution. You're like, wow, I'm the person that, and then you're like, well, I can just pick and choose what I want to do now.
I do feel like that is the pot of gold at the end of the shit rainbow of getting old. Yeah. Like, at this point, I've played every size venue, every type of large event. I've played in like a large number of cool studios. Been in different kinds of co-writing rooms. I've had so many experiences at this point that, yeah, I can just kind of go like, is this something I want? Is this something I don't want? That's also, you know, because I'm a privileged person and I'm in a position to not have to be the primary breadwinner for my family. So both of those factors come into it. Like, also at this point with like the credits that I do have, I have to be careful not to take certain gigs that might cheapen those credits.
Oh my gosh. I'm starting to, I mean, on a smaller scale, but like,
no,
in a way you have to, it's like, oh, I don't do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so weird for your brain. Mm-hmm. I have no shows this weekend.
Wow.
I don't.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You get a weekend to like.
Thank you.
Maybe write and like actually experience this space.
Sleep. I'm not drinking and taking baths. Like, yes. Maybe that's what I want right now instead of playing a honky tonk that doesn't pay me what I want and is not worth my time and effort. But how, I mean, because I know you have two residences basically. Like, so you were living in Nashville and living here. And I remember talking about you wanting people still to be like, she's in Nashville all the time, where at the drop of a hat you could still be there.
Mm-hmm.
So that, how are you dealing with that? It seems like you're so at peace with that shift, kind of.
Yeah, there's been a lot. There's been a slow fade of a major shift for me ever since we moved to Mexico, really. Yeah. That was the shift. But also, like, so yeah, for the first 3 years of living secretly in Austin, I just like straight up lied to people about where I lived. But it was
fine. I lied to so many people for you.
You did? Oh,
thanks. I was like, you're going to have to go to Nashville if you want.
Right? Oh my God, I love that. And it honestly, It was a lie that I didn't feel like was hurting anybody, because basically what it was doing was insulating them from worrying about me coming with a logistical burden of like a plane ticket or do these dates, is this a long enough trip for you? Like, I just don't want anyone to have to think about that stuff. And I wanted to keep playing with my friends. But when we moved, it was COVID and everyone was doing everything remotely anyway, including co-writes. So that worked out great at the time. But the bigger shift in me has been kind of like healing the original like brokenness in me that made me pursue like the big stage. You know, not saying that just because you want to do something ambitious, you're broken. But I think along the ways, a lot of the need to be somebody became this like open wound that was like keeping me from like moving on to whatever was next. You know what I mean? So the first time, so we moved to Mexico for 6 months and I just actually couldn't take stuff that came my way. And I had to deal with the stress of losing certain accounts that if I'm gone for 6 months, they forget about me. Those are the accounts that I'm willing to lose. And when I came back, all the accounts that I really valued were still there waiting for me.
Oh my God.
You know, but it stopped me feeling like I was an active participant in like what you would think of when you think of the rat race of Nashville. I kind of disqualified myself and I have not looked back. Like the huge deep well of fulfillment and love that I have found in allowing myself to be nobody, and just like realizing how I've created this family of people that like I just want to be with them no matter what, like no matter what's happening in the world, like we'll stand on our front porch together and just like watch the bombs together or like you know, like these are my people. And then everything comes out from that and I don't feel this frantic need to like, you know, appear as someone who sparkles and shines and glows in a crowd. Like it's okay for me to be one of the crowd. It's okay for me to like join the human race basically. And it's really hard to like sum it up, but I feel like that's the biggest difference in me now from like pre-Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you say that because I don't feel like you are that person at all. So it's like, and you would say that about me. Right?
Totally. And yeah, because I've always been somewhat aware of it and like talking through it and like, but there's always been the piece of me inside that just like, I mean, I used to wake up in the middle of the night just like anxiety attacking like because of thinking about the gigs I'm not getting or the sessions I'm not getting called for or like my career going in the wrong direction or whatever. And like that doesn't happen anymore.
Well, I think it's, well, that's great. But I think, because I think it's, you know, you never know. I mean, as an artist, I can't be the girl that's on tour working hard forever. Like at some point I have to be this person that is not that person. That's going to be a whole identity shift. And it already is, but that doesn't mean that I didn't achieve all these things, which like you've achieved everything. So to me, you did that, but that doesn't mean you like fade, but it feels like it's a weird thing. Cause I'm like, oh, that's Rachel. Like everybody that talks about you is like, Rachel Loy is such a badass. She kicks so much ass. And like, you're not, like, not that there's anything wrong with being in the crowd, but like, you can never be that person.
Aw.
That's how I feel. But then it's like,
that's how I feel about you too.
And then, but like, if I'm not getting a call, then I'm like, oh, I'm not getting, but you can't be the person that gets the calls forever.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be.
No, it actually gets boring.
Yeah.
Like, not to, I mean, and even that is such a privileged thing to say that I got to the point where I'm like, yeah, like
I already played the CMA Awards 25 times.
I think I'm done.
I think I'm done.
Those are long days, like of doing things I don't love to do. Like I think I won't do that anymore. I'm
done. And then they don't call and you're like, why didn't you call me?
Yeah.
It's I know. Mm-hmm. I know. I don't want to kill myself on the road and then it's like, well, I don't have any shows this weekend. Nobody loves me. Like, what is wrong with me? This is exactly what I wanted. I'm making more money this month by playing half as many shows. Like, this is what I've worked for, but it's so, and I love talking to you about all of this stuff, and we got to get to play a little before we run out of
out of time. Sure. Can you tell people why, real quick, why you moved to Mexico and like how good you are at singing in Spanish? And like, because we made a record that was partly in Spanish.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And how I think that was, because we've made three projects now, technically, mm-hmm. but like how the next one, I want it to be even more leaned into like the hybrid.
Ooh, love that.
So like now you're more poised. I made your Mexico trip about me, which is.
Yeah, I love that.
You were like, let's just go.
Mexico. Well, yeah, because Brian and I, well, you know, in retrospect, I can see we were like, there were some things in our relationship that weren't working well. And there were some things with me and my whole history of music in Nashville that were, I felt like I was in like a really high tension kind of place, kind of depressed, kind of bored with life, not knowing what was next. And Brian was leading a team of Argentinians, and he was like, I really need to learn Spanish. Like, and then I remember what it was. We were on vacation in Colorado at this place that all of our friends recommended to us, and we were just not having a good time. We were like, why do we hate vacations?
Yeah.
You know? And we were like, you know, it would be fun if we went to Puerto Rico and learned Spanish for 6 months and just lived there. And we were like, oh, that would be so rad. Anyway, Puerto Rico turned into Merida, Yucatan, because it was actually an easier, more affordable flight. And it was super safe. And there was like better electricity and also more Spanish immersion. So we ended up switching to that. But it was really just like, it sounded really fun to us.
Yeah.
I turned 40 while we were there, and I was like, I don't know what I want for my 40th birthday, but I know I want to be in Mexico. And so it was just like, we literally just wanted to do it. And then we went through with all the difficult logistics of getting three kids enrolled in school yeah. in Mexico and, you know, got the visas that we needed or whatever and just did it. And everyone thought we were crazy. We kind of thought we were crazy.
I did not think you were crazy.
You didn't?
I was incredibly jealous of you. Just green with envy. Just like so mad at you for 6 months. But no.
You guys got to do it.
We were so happy for you, for real.
Yeah.
We were like, that is the dream.
You should do it.
We need to do it. You know, Paul did it for a month. He did a long time ago. He lived with a Spanish speaking family and everything.
Wow.
We want to do it because you just, yeah. You said even at home, you guys would all just speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm. A couple days a week we try. Yeah. But that kind of fades. There's a lot of resistance from the kids. They just, I mean,
yeah,
they're only in the B2 with English, you know, so.
Yeah, right. They're still learning.
Yeah, they're still English. Learning English.
Yeah. And you came back with
Ruby's
a
like,
Mexican
what does
dog?
Register mean? I'm like, oh yeah, you probably don't know that word, you know?
Right.
You know?
And you're learning Spanish simultaneously. Mm-hmm. No, I think that's very fun. And what an adventure. And then you got Blanco, the doggy.
Yes. We got our awesome, perfect dog. I mean, I just don't see how you could get a better dog.
That is
dog.
A really good dog. Mm-hmm. Like, she is so sweet. And she's napping right now. You can't see her, but.
Well, it's a he. And
oh my God, I know. You
know? But all dogs are female for you.
I know
so
that
I
an O
that.
Is masculine and an A is feminine. I know that much about Spanish. Sorry. Yeah. Blanco, lo siento, señor. Okay. Ay, ay, ay.
No se importa.
I know. Yeah, I'm sleeping. Quiero dormir. Anyway, very happy for you on that. And then last, but before we switch to play a little, because I just love your solo record so much.
Oh,
and
thanks.
If you have not done a Rachel Loy Spotify dive, you have. It's just, they're so good. Like, your solo records, are you good? Is there any plans to do more of that on the table, or have you done it behind my back and didn't tell me?
I mean, I have this collection of songs that I was like jokingly calling my greatest hits because they've never been released, but they're like the best songs I've ever written. Like, and I've been gradually collecting them, and I want to put them out, but like, man, I wrote them a long time ago and I can't feel them anymore. So then I like tried to get a friend to co-produce it with me. But then at the time he wasn't busy, but then he like quickly got really busy. So yeah. It kind of fell off the table. Like, okay, just putting this out there to the universe. I want to make another record, but I need a producer.
I'll do it. I'm just kidding. That's so exciting.
Yeah.
Well, to have a co-producer, that is because you've pretty much the last few have been just you producing, right?
Or yeah, and just like the idea, I know the mountain of work that it would take to get them to where I want them, or the mountain of money, like yeah. either one. Like I could do it for free with all of these hours, like, but I would be diving into songs that like I'm having a hard time getting a clear transmission from because they're from the past, and right. and also there's the aspect of like you have this awesome audience, you know, that love you and they're like waiting for the next thing to come out. But I have not done the work to nurture my own audience. So like the shelf life of the records I put out is just like a week of making kind of irritating posts on Instagram and then like done, poof, there went that, you know? But like I literally am sitting on, actually there's a couple songs that are done. Like there's a song called Too Much Love that Brian arranged strings for. And it's just me and a quartet. And it's like the most beautiful thing I've ever made. And I should just freaking put it out. But I have this like resistance to the process right now of putting it out. At the same time, all of that kind of energy towards apps and computers and all that kind of thing, I just put towards Playola because that feels like something that is actually going to make a difference. And this kind of feels like a whole bunch of effort for like making hardly a ripple, you know?
Well, that's how we all feel though. I mean, mm-hmm. like that's how I feel. I feel like it's all my time and all my money and everything. We make this great thing. And then after a week, people are like, okay, what's next? Like that's yeah. exactly how I feel.
Yeah.
So it's so frustrating, mm-hmm. you know, and we have two songs that we did that I'm sitting on because I don't want to go make the promotional right. videos, but also because it takes so much time and effort to give it, we say like the love that it deserves as a release. But even if you do all that, it might still not get the love. Yeah. So then it's just like,
yeah,
it's just, that's the resistance because mm-hmm. it's like, it requires so much work. But then even if you do the work that everyone says you have to do, mm-hmm. it might still not make that big of mm-hmm. an effect. So then you're double disappointed because yeah. you want to give it the love and then you do mm-hmm. it doesn't work out. Anyway, so
And the old routes are not, or like the old ways of doing things, those opportunities are like less well loved and attended at this point. Like it used to be when I put records out that I would like book a CD release show and like right. but now the infrastructure for like having a big show and getting the word out also involves all this online work, so you really have to do both if you want to experience synergy and community around releasing a record. And all of that, I know that I only have limited effort because I do have three kids, and like I just know I don't want to like overcommit to doing something and then not do it all the way. But I have definitely tried to like build up steam and momentum around releasing music. And I just keep running into the same, like, I'd rather put that into Playola.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think that too, the importance of you releasing records depends a lot on my happiness. So if you could factor that into there.
Yes. That is a big factor in all the decisions I make.
Actually. I knew it.
And the grocery
your
list.
Your Costco like, run. Yeah, I know. Uh-huh, uh-huh. But Swan Dive's so good. I was listening the other day. It was the one that My Heartbreak, The Way My Heart Breaks. Oh yeah. My gosh. Like I forgot how good that was. I was just like driving and crying. I was like, this is so good. You're very good at making songs melodically sound different, even my songs with the chords you put underneath. And I think as a producer, I've had people in the past, and I'm not talking about some of my records that are out, like please don't make assumptions about who I'm talking about, I hate that, but who are just like, I did this and I did that. And like I remember specifically with Cowboy Cold, I said wow, these chords are amazing. And you were like, those are the chords you meant to put under there. You just didn't. And I was like, that's so nice. Cause you're not like, yeah, I did this. And you, or anytime we do things, you make them feel very collaborative when aww. I'm like, oh, that was Rachel Loy for sure. But that's very thoughtful. And maybe do you think that's because you were also an artist?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't, that's not like lip service. I mean, like awesome. I genuinely think that the song that you had in your mind was like, you know, one of those like 90s, like Brooks and Dunn kinds of songs mm-hmm. that would have those kinds of chords, the like two minor to five mm-hmm. kind of, or three minor, like just the more like circle of fifths kind of sound, you know, like where they move around, they have a little more tension. like, it wasn't lip service. I do think that with the melody that you were writing, you were hearing those chords.
Thank you.
But they weren't in your fingers. So you just needed me to identify it.
I needed you to say circle of fifths because I've never said that before. That's not in my vocabulary.
That was some really nerdy Berkeley shit.
It was so
sorry.
Nerdy. Anyway, and the pop record you made is so epic.
Oh, my God.
I tell
God,
you,
thank you.
We listened to it in the van. Like, we used to listen to it all the time. It's so epic. You can do such a range of things. And I think that also when you release new music or when you go in to make a record or if you're saying you need a producer, it's because you can do such a range of music. Like, what I don't even know what I would even describe those solo records as sounding like.
I know. And maybe, like, I don't know, maybe I've always needed someone to, like, rein me in a little bit, but then again, maybe not. I mean, really, I just need endless budget. That's what I need. Endless budget, time budget, money budget.
Right.
Oh, and I was going to say, like, right now, if I was going to, like, get behind a record release of my own, it would be for Vagiant, my rock band.
Right. I was going to bring that up.
Mm-hmm.
Vagiant is the best name. And it's all women.
Yeah.
Girl band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we need a guitar player because we had a guitar player and now we don't.
That's hard.
I know. So that is the thing that I'm like, oh, but I can't. How am I going to perform? There is a great guitar player, but she's kind of like not living in Austin exactly. But she did some overdubs and I'm like, oh, this chick would be awesome. But she doesn't really live here.
Susan.
Susan?
Tedeschi.
Susan Tedeschi.
Just give her a call. Kelly Green plays for Madam Ray. It's hard. I mean, like, just like female bass players. Mm-hmm. It's like.
I kind of want a girl who's like, did not, like, her formative riffs were not blues riffs. And she does not claim, like, I'm a blues guitar player.
Okay, that's.
I don't want that.
Doubly hard.
All of them.
That's all of them.
Yeah. I want someone who likes messing around with weird sounds and pedals and is influenced by Radiohead. Like, that's the kind of guitar player
that I
need.
Well, listen, this turned into an ad. Give us a call.
I'm holding national auditions.
That is really interesting. And why do you think that there's not as many girls that dive into bass and guitar? Like, is that why?
I have theories about it. Do we have time for me to give my theory?
I mean, yeah, give your theory.
Okay. My theory, at least for people who grew up around the same time as me, so let's say 80s, 90s, or like early aughts. First of all, there's not a lot of like examples that we had, but I think that's a small factor. I think the biggest factor is that male musicians spend the most of their woodshedding years, which is basically when you're doing, when you're learning riffs off other records and when you're doing dexterity exercises like scales, and it kind of has like a target practice kind of feel to it. There's not an emotional catharsis in learning an instrument in the beginning, none at all. And this is the kind of work that male brains love when they're in high school.
Paul Eason.
Yeah.
13 years old.
Yeah.
Guitar, could not put it down. Me, 13 years old, chasing the boys and upset that my face was breaking out and like trying to fit in my jeans and I couldn't because like it was all body centric or emotional. I don't know.
Or just like different. Talking on your phone for hours.
Yeah.
Or like in these are things that are healthy for women in high school.
Hmm.
Healthy. Like this is what our brains were like designed to do. Hmm. This part of us used to be how we stayed safe together. We made strong tribes of women to protect ourselves against the men who used to be unchecked and they have weapons attached to them between their legs. And so like this is not a bad part of being a woman. This is a sign that we're functioning well. And that's how I was in high school too. I hated practicing. Oh no, I started practicing. I did most of my woodshedding in middle school when I was homeschooled.
Oh,
so I was kind of like lonely and friendless anyway. My best friend had moved away the year before. I had quit ballet and my dad had given me this bass and was like, this is, you know, I thought the bass was just like so expensive. I couldn't figure out how much it actually was, but I felt very indebted to him and that he was investing in me. And I felt like I wanted to show him that I was grateful and serious. So
oh, wow.
I set a timer every day for 30 minutes and I practiced every day. But did I enjoy it?
No.
Not one single moment of it. It was all because I was compelled to do it out of discipline and out of admiration for my dad. And I'm really grateful that I had that. The minute that I started to enjoy it was when it became social. And that was about a year later in rock and roll camp. And so my theory is that women, you're swimming upstream as a woman trying to learn an instrument during the time of life where that's possible, where you don't have to pay your bills and you have free time.
Yeah.
And you also have the fine motor skills of an adult, right? That's the time to do it. Women don't ever feel like doing that kind of work. And I think that's the main reason why, but women are not instrumentalists. Some of them, there's exception to those rules, and they either enjoy practicing or, like me, they had a different impetus to practice.
Mm-hmm.
By the time music became social, because of the combo of like a natural propensity for it and the amount of hours I had already put in, I was like the best one, the youngest one and the only female. And I got really addicted to that feeling.
That's a good feeling.
It's a good feeling.
I was also the only girl on the festival. Mm-hmm. The only one that yep. had a band, still one of the only ones doing it. And it is a very good feeling. And then here comes like the weight of the responsibility of that. But also like, it's a very addictive feeling mm-hmm. to be like, I can do it when nobody else can. Mm-hmm. I've somehow cut through
yep.
this barrier.
To walk around feeling like there should be a documentary about me.
Yeah, like there is a couple. Someone's really bad. Don't watch it. No,
that makes sense.
Yeah, that's very interesting. We share that. And then, gosh, this is too easy. And you're real quick. You have a podcast now. Uh-huh. And I'm a little bit behind on your podcast.
Oh,
it's really good.
Thanks.
It's called Hey, Good For You. That is so you. Like, that's the most perfect title. And tell everybody who's your co-hosts and I guess the premise, maybe.
Yeah, my co-hosts are Harmony Kelly, bass player for Kenny Chesney.
No biggie. Also, she's so nice.
So cool.
Yeah, she's the greatest thing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Love hanging out with her. I feel like the whole reason that we do the podcast at this point is to just nurture our friendship.
Totally. We should start a podcast.
We're
going to just make another record.
And Allison Presswood. Mm-hmm. Who has way more credits than I do in the studio and started years before me when I imagine the glass ceiling was even lower.
Mm-hmm.
And she managed to be the only female tracking musician in Nashville by tracking musician, I mean like on the tracking floor as the main part of the arrangements going down, not an overdub musician. There have been other female fiddle players, keyboard players who neither Allison or I ever came into contact with. So she knows the feeling of being the only female in the small circle of session musicians on Music Row. And I know that feeling too, but she came before me and she is a complete badass.
She's so awesome. And it's cool to hear her be vulnerable about like the one time she played with, I can't remember who it was, maybe Ronnie Crowell or someone like that. And she's mm-hmm. like, I just walked in there with stand up bass. There was no click track and I had to like lead the trio. And and you're like, oh, you're the person that could do this above anybody that I know. And to hear her kind of just be vulnerable is really mm-hmm. fun because we all have these things and it's a very unique perspective, but it's a really fun podcast. Everyone should listen mm-hmm. to it. Your guests are incredible.
Thank you.
Like, really good job.
Thank you. Yes.
And now you're working on Playola with your husband, Brian Keem. We never said his full name. One of my favorite songwriters.
Mm.
And you guys have launched this radio-ish, very unique app that is very exciting. I got a text from my best friend Rachel. Her mom texted me and was like, thank you so much for the Playola code. I'm obsessed.
Oh,
all
wow.
capital letters.
Amazing.
People who are finding it love it.
Yeah. So
it's very unique because, for example, my station has kind of its own voice. It's songs that I pick. Mm-hmm. It's songs that I introduce. It's the stories behind my songs. It's updated and fresh weekly where mm-hmm. I can kind of tell everyone what I'm up to. I can go live from the road. I can get my band to talk. It's just fun.
Mm-hmm. It's really fun. And the listeners love it.
The listeners love it.
They're obsessed. They're like, I don't ever listen to radio anymore. So our goal is to definitely replace radio, not Spotify. We want to be the place where people go when they don't want to decide what they feel like listening to that day.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you can trust that my station has cool stuff on it.
Oh my gosh.
It's so cool. Good.
Because Craig Vaughn is on it now.
Yeah. Craig Vaughn is helping us. And helping us. Did you like how I just looped myself into your
you
company?
Are all of the artists at this point are absolutely like, in my mind, like co-founders, because the amount of investment that you guys have made into this tiny little app before we are big enough to make money is like really impactful.
It's really fun. And mm-hmm. you know, we're going to put my podcast on there eventually where you yeah. can listen to it before anyone else. And I'm glad. This seems like something that's like really put a lot of fire in your eyes. Like you just seem really excited about it. And because it's helpful to artists, like I think it yeah. makes you feel good.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, honestly, like it's been so invigorating, me and Brian working on this, because it's almost like revisiting where we were at when we first got together 21 years ago.
Oh my gosh.
Like we were both fighting the good fight for our solo careers, our sideman careers. Like we were just so in it all the time, and it was up and down, and it was like we were so poor, and we were like, yeah. And there's a similar feeling to that now. It's different in all the ways that it should be, mm-hmm. you know, but there's that same like roller coaster of emotions where some days we're just like almost just like it almost feels manic, like oh, I can't wait to go work on Blayola because we gotta, you know yeah. what I mean? And then there's days where it just feels like, oh my god, what are we doing? Like, are we, is this like, this is never going to happen. Yeah. Like, I mean, it really swings so hard.
Yeah.
On the daily. That's why we started drinking again.
Oh, well, that's, listen, I'm taking a break so you can, we're just doing a little flippy flop. Yeah. But it is, you know, the music thing, it really kicks you and rewards you and kicks you and rewards you. And mm-hmm. after, you know, Paul's been doing it 20 years. I've been about 15. And after a while, it just gets like, so you get so over that roller coaster.
You do.
A little bit.
You do.
And it's not even exciting when something like the best thing ever happens. Yeah. You're like, cool. Yeah. Like, whatever. I deserve that. I've been at it 15 years. It's about time I get something rewarding me instead of like, wow, this is amazing. It's mm-hmm. like, no.
Yeah.
You know,
maybe it's about at the same time to go back to when I was saying like, I actually should not take certain gigs. At the same time that starts happening,
yeah.
the rewards start feeling like just kind of like a bare minimum expectation yeah. versus like a huge honor. I can't believe it. Also like perspective. I don't mean to sound like all the music things feel like negative to me. I don't feel mm. negatively about them, but it is missing the feeling that it used to have for me, which is like, you know, I don't know. It's like we've been down so many different paths now. Mm-hmm. To experience rewards on those same paths is just different than being down a completely different path and experiencing the rewards
and
the
risks.
Yeah.
Right. Or yeah. even just like money is fun to make and getting True. The opportunity to True. Have unlimited money or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. things like that are really exciting. And I know that for me, the thing that is exciting is figuring out a way to make enough money to make another record with you. Like that's yeah. like in my, because those are some of the best times of my life was like making our records, you know?
Same.
And I do want to say, I say this all the time on the podcast, but one thing that I really, really appreciate about you that I just want to say is like, I remember telling you that I feel like I'm everyone's friend and I'm no one's friend. Like everyone, but I didn't have like a tribe really. Mm-hmm. And you were like, let's make one. I don't know why I talk like that. Wait, that's not how you sound.
Is that my caricature in your head? Just like, yeah, let's make one.
If you're a valley girl and you're dumb.
I do have a no, small voice.
No. I think it's like the attitude or the conviction. Like it's less valley girl. It's more like, let's make one. Like mm-hmm. right now. Mm-hmm. And you did. You created this music couples therapy group for us that has yeah. been just a light of my life. It's just like people that are like-minded. We get together. No one is ever telling me, here's what you should do. Or here's what you're doing wrong. Everyone's like, yeah, dude, that happened to me. And that community has been like the highlight of my life.
Oh, me too. I always think of that group when it's like, especially when you're dealing with like the stress and the overwhelm of being just like out on a limb doing something that you believe in. Everybody in that group is there all the time and being an adult in it, yeah. you know, and that really is hard to find.
It's hard to find
because you can have close friends that are adults, but most of them don't know that grind.
Yeah. Or you're sitting at a table with them and they're like, you don't think big enough or something. And I'm like, I'm driving. I'm exhausted. Like,
yeah,
I'm trying to think as big as I possibly can. It doesn't, your business does not translate to mine. Mm-hmm. That's very difficult. Mm-hmm. And nobody has ever offended me in that music group. Mm-hmm. No one's told me I look tired.
Mm-mm. We all love you so much. Well, we all love each other.
Well, I can't say enough good things about your writing, your playing, your producing. Now your new venture that's just artist centric. You're a good human. You're an exceptional mom, wife. I could talk to you for days, but thanks for chatting with me on this podcast.
Of course. And I feel the same way about you. Yeah. I admire you just as much as all those lovely things you just said to me. Like, I'm hugely, huge. I'm a huge fan of you and your work ethic and your abilities and your brain.
My tiny woman brain?
Your tiny woman brain.
How do you play bass with those tiny woman hands?
I don't know. I honestly, you don't need big fingers to play bass, guys. Just putting that out there into the universe. And but your songwriting is incredible. It's my favorite in Texas. It's so good.
You've helped me a lot with that. And thanks for being patient with my songs. And I'm sorry I called you a girl, Blanco. Okay, everybody. Thanks, Kyle. Adios. Before you fuck up with the instructions.